Today on the Brooklyn Film Theorists, we'll be discussing the Brooklyn College Film Festival with our special guest, Alex Seuss.
Say hi, Alex.
Hello, Alex.
Sorry, Rick.
Hi, Alex.
No, this is Alex Seuss. Alex.
Hi, I'm Alex Seuss.
Yes. He's joining us, our special discussion of the film festival. We will also have another guest, Cal Robertson, on later, and then we will close out with a discussion of X-Men First Class. I'm Rick Rosette.
I'm Mark Jarowski, and I just want to take a moment before we jump into the man to let you guys know this is episode 20, this is episode 20 of the Brooklyn Film Theorists, which is, you know, a big deal for us.
Yes.
And here's Top Dollar Roz's The Man. Listen to the man, listen to the man. If you want me to know that you're a fan, but you won't ever let up, I don't give a goddamn, but this thing is what it's getting, it's something I demand, my suggestion is you. Listen to the man. I'm Papa Joe Jackson. I don't give a fraction. I'm what you pay to see. Like a paralyzed backstory. Welcome to the faction. Let me bring the facts. You don't want drama, cause I bring the action. Ask him. Top dollars like a Unabomber. I got him all scared in the hotel Rwanda. Trying to survive, I'm suggesting that you hide. Cause I'm performing whack, rapper, mass genocide. I know that you're sick of them. Come and get your medicine. I'm the most feared, revered of all reverence. Cause I bring the gospel. And we're back. That was, as always, Top Dollar Roz the Man. You can get his catch his music on Bandcamp or iTunes. He just had a new album out a couple of months ago, The New Flesh. Now, without further ado, we're going to jump into the 29th annual Brooklyn College Film Festival with our special guest, Alex Seuss. Let's get started. We'll start with thoughts.
Okay.
I think we'll start with thoughts on the festival. And I really enjoyed it. I had gone 2 years prior, and I had to miss it last year, which was the year of my graduation, because I had a final that same day, unfortunately. But I was really impressed by the quality of the cinematography and the sound on the films. They were clearly finished products that made it into the festival, and there was a lot of different subject matter. One thing that I was kind of... I guess I kind of regretted that there weren't enough comedic films. There was a lot of heavy, sometimes heavy-handed drama. I won't name names. And everything looked good and played well, and there was clearly a great sense of community to it. And I guess looking from the outside in, I felt like, you know, I felt like I was really proud of the work people put in. And the one film, just want to say that Alex did a lot of work on a lot of people's films. He'll talk about that in a minute. I just want to say my personal favorite was Stay Wide Awake by Jeremy
Puglisi.
Puglisi.
Yep.
Yeah. So, Jeremy, if you're listening to this, great work. You really think you made a really unusual film. And the imagery and the editing and the acting, which I think got some great performances out, really stuck with me. Some other films I enjoyed. Thought the faculty selection was a lot of, I wish it wasn't all so dramatic, but there were a lot of, like, clearly, you know, top of the line visually and sound-wise. I love the temple. I thought it was...
By Philippe Grenade Willis.
Yeah, and I thought it was completely, and shot by Jared Egan, I thought it was on a different level where, you know, as far as cinematography was concerned, that's a given. I mean, that was a big, there was a lot of hype about it, and with I mean, it had a significant budget. Not named figures. From what I know, it has significant budget. And it felt a little bit like it belonged at a different festival because it didn't feel like a Brooklyn College film. It really didn't. It felt like a film that was made by Brooklyn College students outside of the limitations of the film school.
That is exactly what it was, because they had like people brought on from like a, you know, professional AC brought in from DC and crew brought
an
in
AC from DC.
Yes, they had the AC from DC. So they were able
AC/DC.
With the budget they were working with, which I would say was about, you know, three times what other, you know, film students were working with. They were able to do a lot, but if anyone else had that budget, who knows what they would have been able to do at
it's
the same
time. It's their right, and I think they did a great job with the budget they had. Alex?
Yeah, actually, that's kind of one of the issues that I had with a couple of the films. There was that one and, one other. I feel like the spirit of the Brooklyn College Film Festival is that this is supposed to be the sum of all of the education that Brooklyn College has given us, and it's kind of outside of the spirit of it to use a primarily non-Brooklyn College crew. Obviously, these are people who have worked in the field, and that's great. And it's great to bring that professional element to your film. At the same time, you know, what I want to see is my, you know, friends and peers, and see what I've learned, and see how the same education that I've received is put to use in these films. And I feel like, yes, you know, The Temple, for instance, was brilliantly shot, but there were, you know, parts of it that, yeah, felt like it was, should have been a different festival. And that's because, you know, it maybe should have, because it was not necessarily a Brooklyn College film. There were only a handful of people who were Brooklyn College students.
But we are all friends with the directors, Ethan Donnelly, who we actually came on the show, excuse me, to discuss Saltwater, a film that he had worked on while being a student of Brooklyn College, but with all extraneous people that weren't involved in Brooklyn College. And so do you feel like maybe we're giving Ethan a pass for his film and then like critiquing someone like Philippe for, you know, The Temple?
You know, actually, I talked to him about that, and the point that he brought that up. I said to him, you know, that was one of the issues. I said at the festival, that was one of the issues I had with The Temple. And he said, well, but I had my film. It was mostly non-Brooklyn College people. And I said, yeah, but that wasn't your thesis film, right? This was a film that he did that was for an independent study after his thesis film. And his thesis film used all Brooklyn College crew, and it got into the festival on its own merits, you know.
Are you implying that The Temple didn't?
No. I'm saying that as opposed to a film like Saltwater, which, you know, maybe had a bump, possibly. Like, we don't know what it could have been without a Brooklyn College, with a Brooklyn College crew, as opposed to an outside crew. And the same with The Temple. We don't know what The Temple could have been if it had had a Brooklyn College crew. Maybe it would have been the same, and I would have hoped they would have been the same because of the quality of education that we've all received. But it could have been different, and we'll never know that, and we don't know whether it was specifically Jared, who is a really great DP, and I've seen some of his other stuff, or if it was...
No, he has a reel on Vimeo, Jared Egan. I mean, great work. Anyone can go see, if you go on Vimeo, look up Jared Egan, and you can see, like, the quality of work.
Right, and his work is absolutely fantastic, but, you know, we'll never know whether the production as a whole would have had that same kind of, you know, swim as opposed to sink, if it had used a primarily Brooklyn College crew.
So what were your...
Can I just respond to that?
No, it's okay.
Just speaking, I mean, the reason, I think one of the reasons we have you on here is because you really, and this is, you know, something that I respect about you, really make it your business to be involved in this thriving Brooklyn College film community. And, you know, it, to me, with the hindsight that I have, it is a very close-knit community, and that's both a pro and a con. And I think in regards to, say, Ethan's film, which I'm actually sorry I forgot to mention, I've been involved with Saltwater in the casting process, so, and just watching the production of it, seeing cuts so much that when I saw it at the festival, it was like I was seeing another cut, and, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing more work from Ethan. And in any case, we're close friends, we're collaborating on a script, so just slipped my mind, I guess. But in regards to something like The Temple or Saltwater, I feel like I have to give it up for filmmakers who actually do go out of the sphere of the community to try to find outside. I mean, I understand about respecting the community and giving talented people in it work, but I also and appreciate that kind of industrious spirit where you go out and you get a non-Brooklyn College crew and you still make the film you're intending to make, because for a variety of reasons, you may have some people working, but you might just not be, you know... I guess I'm speaking from personal experience. I won't lie. I'll lay it out here. I never felt like I was really in, you know, in with the in crowd. So for me, for my films that I worked on, I utilized a small crew of people that I kind of was close to. And in retrospect, I would have loved to work. And, you know, there's still an opportunity to work with plenty of the people at this year's festival or a couple of years past. And, you know, that said, I feel like credit is due to either or. I mean... And I think sometimes more credit may be due to people who had the kind of the courage to go out and seek out a crew of people they absolutely didn't know, didn't have relationships with, and utilize them for a film. And the films that turned out well are, you know.
Well, I was just going to say, Alex, what are some of the highlights of the festival you felt after going in? Like, just certain films or certain aspects of the festival you want to touch on?
I mean, I really, honestly, you know, all credit to Jarrett, because I really did think, as far as cinematography, Jarrett's work was great, and the guy that we'll, you know, hear from later on, Cal, who's sitting next to me, so I don't want to look at him as I'm saying it, his work is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoy his DP work. You know, writing wise, I felt though that this was not the strongest year for Brooklyn College. I feel like last year there was better writing in the scripts, and this year there was a lot more, which is great to hear. There's a lot more emphasis being put on you know, visual storytelling and how pretty things are. But at the end of the day, I feel like sometimes a film, at least outside of the kind of sort of insular Brooklyn College film community, you know, can't just survive on being pretty alone. It stops being memorable if it's just pretty.
Well, yeah, that's I would say that's all films in right. general. Like most of the films Mark and I cover, that's like the first thing we talk about when we don't like a film is, God, this story was just so... Like, right. middling, it just didn't have enough. So, I mean, it's right. I think it's safe to say that.
So, I mean, but and actually something that's sad, and I am completely biased because I edited it, but Come Clean, John Marin's film, I really liked the writing on that. I thought it was, you know, it was a very... It wasn't the most complex comedy. It was definitely not a cerebral comedy.
No, I actually was assistant director on that. I was there during right. the making. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I'm biased because I listen to these lines over and over again. But at the same time, I'm gonna say that, you know, editing it and sitting there listening to these lines over and over again and like figuring out new ways to cut things. And then at the end of the day, I sat down in that theater like everyone else, and I watched that cut like everyone else, and I laughed. Even after everything, you know, you'd think those lines at some point, those jokes would get kind of stale. But, like, watching them up there and, like, seeing the final execution, I thought it was really tight.
And I think just to kind of build off the point you're making, Alex, is that's been a knock on Brooklyn College in general, is just even a joke amongst, like, the filmmaking crews, is that Brooklyn College traditionally produces a lot of people involved in the cinematography field, maybe some producers, people working in development. But what you don't see is a lot of writers coming out of a program that right now is run by a former screenwriter, Dan Gerskis, who he was a very accomplished screenwriter before this. We can like go on IMDb and see he's worked on feature films. And he's actually one of the reasons I came to Brooklyn College. I read an article in Movie Maker magazine saying that the program was run by a gentleman that had worked in Hollywood, and it was like a bang for your buck school. So, you know, being someone that's not from New York, that was the reason I came to the school. And for me, I want to say that I thought the writing was, you know, all right. I thought there was some good writing, obviously, in the films. But the highlights for me were the last two films of the night. Little Brother, directed by Cal Robertson, who we do have here, and then The Temple, which we've already touched on. But to me, those films were like the top tier films. And I actually produced Jeremy's film, the one that you spoke of, and I'm very proud of that film, but because of story issues in that it wasn't very clear, I knew going in, and I think Jeremy knew deep down in his heart that this is a film that's not going to appeal to a mass audience. However, with Little Brother and The Temple, when it came time for the awards at the end of the night, those films didn't sweep. And I feel like that's where the political process of a festival tied to a school, that's where the political, you know, issues creep in, because it should have been a sweep of either of those films, in my opinion. How do you guys feel about this?
Alex, you can go ahead.
I mean, yeah. I'm not asking you to, like, name names. I'm just saying, like, in most film festivals, you would get sweep of the films that are, like, upper tier.
At the same time, I feel like, there was a sweep last year with the... With Yogurt Cups, yeah, thank you.
Who was that?
Camila Tika,
yeah, yeah, something like that. Camila had this film that, you know, it wasn't the best writing necessarily, but it dealt with it was about pot, so everyone.
It's like a medical marijuana comedy drama. I thought it was actually dramedy. Pretty like endearing.
It was it was solid, but it was simple, I felt like. But this isn't about last year's festival. The thing is that, like, normally I feel like there should have been more of a sweep. And when I was sitting there in the audience and I was doing my picks, I got a couple of them wrong just because I had put the same film down for, like, several, or the same films, the same people down for several categories because I was like, oh, well, you know, these people have such a body of work that, you know, you're surprised that, you know, someone who is necessarily known for being excellent in this field doesn't win the award for that field. And that kind of shocked me.
I guess for me, what I'm digging at is, like, I feel like, you know, and there was a lot of deserving films. I'm not saying The Temple and The Little Brother were the only films. The Faculty Screening Select had, I'll just go over the films. It was a short film called Home by Sammy Kim, Alex Anonymous, directed by Lauren Boyce, Flamingo by Lee Rossoff, which Lee won Best Screenwriting and Best Picture. And then there was Lillian by Motomo Ishigaki, Family Ties by Anastasia Federyaka. I'm sorry, it's a Russian name, Mark. I need a translator on this one.
I guess Federyaka.
Oh, that was beautiful. That's why we have Mark here. Yes. Yeah. Translation. And then In Transit by Rachel Adkins, which Rachel won the Audience Award for best, you know, film, and then she also won a special Women in Film Award. Funhouse by Ben Guzman, then of course Little Brother by Cal Robertson, and The Temple by Philippe Grenade. So those were the films that were up for the awards, and I'm not necessarily saying that, like, I disagree with all the picks, but I just felt like certain awards went to people based on maybe who members of the faculty or something had to deal with, and that's where, like, I think if Brooklyn College, what I'm finally getting at, is going, if their festival is going to grow, which it's already in the process of growing, they need to have a system that is less political and more based on just like pure subjective feeling based on the film. Like, people should just shoot from the hip and go for it, because I felt like there was too much, like, one award goes here, one award goes here, and, like, they're dividing it up like a piece of pie.
Are you talking about in terms of the faculty should be more subjective, or that, you know, handing over all of the awards to the people that show up to the festival, or the student body?
I guess maybe the faculty, because I felt like they were kind of, like, playing both sides of the fiddle, like, giving out several different awards to several different people. And so it's hard to say, like, what the best film is when different people are winning all these different awards. You don't really see... Like, Flamingo won Best Picture, but because Lee didn't win Best Director and Rachel won a different award, it's hard to say, like,
Let's not get bogged down semantics.
There is one thing that I had an issue with when we talk about picks, because when they all sit down in the room and they decide what films are going to the festival or not at all, you know, they also decide where things are going to go. And there are some films that, like... I don't know. I didn't feel... There were a couple of films that I didn't feel should have been in the festival at all, and there were a couple of films that I felt like shouldn't have been the faculty select, right? There were films that were, you know, good films in their own right, but they were not third screening films. They were not films that exemplified, you know... I feel like if a film's going to be a faculty select, it needs to be, like, as close to flawless, at least relative to the other films, in cinematography or storytelling, like, one of the two.
Are you about to say all aspects of the mise-en-scène?
No, I'm not.
Okay. That's what you're building to. Okay.
No, that's not the thing I was going to say. But no, I think that, like, that one of the other, it needs to be something where it's like, oh, Brooklyn College is proud of this aspect of the film. Like, proud of it.
Okay.
Mark, in closing, how do you feel about the Brooklyn College Film Festival moving forward? Like, do you, like... Where do you think it's going to head from here? How do you feel about it? What suggestions would you make? Would you make anything?
I don't think I'm in a position to make any suggestions, to tell you the truth. I wish it the best. I don't know if I'll be there next year, but I was really happy to be there this year with a lot of people that I was close to. And I think that community that, I mean, I keep saying this, but that's because I feel strongly about it. I think that's a big part of it. I think Brooklyn College should hold on to it, because even as you kind of, it shouldn't lose the fact that people are really, there's a lot of interpersonal relationships going on, and there's a real sense of clear communication between the faculty and the students, and I think that bodes well for the festival in the future. That said, just my roundup, I got to hold the list from the festival, and now I can actually name films, because I kind of had a brain freeze earlier, and I thought it was a really strong year for documentaries. I really enjoyed Answering Buddha's Call, which was kind of not the most technically efficient documentary, but it kind of, it was tough.
No, I'm saying, I mean,
he shot it like 10 years ago. It was right. Shot 10 years ago, and it was only edited now, and he did all of the the voiceover stuff.
Right, I figured as much. But I felt like it. Yeah. I was emotionally affected by it, and I really liked, because it was a very like intellectual look at something that's deeply spiritual.
Okay.
I really liked Alberto Mujica's Dos, and I read Al's script about, I guess, a year and a half ago, and I was really confused by it because I wasn't quite sure what the film was about. And seeing it on screen, I told him this after the festival. I shook his hand. I said, you know, congrats. You really made it make sense on screen, even though on the page it was kind of murky to me.
You made a film.
Anecdote. Indeed. I worked on Anecdote. Yeah. And again, here was a script. There was a lot of buzz about Anecdote, and Alex is making a face. And I understand why. There's a lot of buzz about Anecdote, and some of it good, some of it bad.
It's because it
the
has
reality
the most
of the film.
Insane reversal
it has
that you will find.
An astounding reversal. Right. We won't spoil it here, but I remember reading the script and going like, wow, this could really go either way on the spectrum. This could be a good film, or this could be The Room.
Yes.
Luckily, for me, it falls closer to like, it's a student film, clearly. It's rooted in that. It's also shot, Cal shot that as well. It looks good.
And I was going to say that, you know, and this is not trying to just kiss his ass because he's in The Room, but like, I think that a lot of it comes from, you know, Cal's DP work. It looks really good.
It was edited very
And then I was also going to say, the other main factor is that the editing is really good.
I think I want to commend Ahmed, and I was the casting director on it, so I guess that's my bias. But I want to commend him on actually pulling off something. It's kind of like a balancing act. And then in the movie, the fact that the audience wasn't dying laughing. And it would be unfortunate. We're immature as people. That's a given. Anybody is immature. And when you're dealing with subject matter like that, it's like, it's very easy to... I'm not going to say what it's about. If you want to know what it's about, see the film. Wrapping up, Bryce. Yes. Just two more films. Okay. Well, three. I want to... Deconstructing Your Mother by...
Jatavia
Gary. Fantastic. I think that's one of the best films at the festival. I think she demonstrated just incredible proficiency at documentary filmmaking. I think her mother is a fascinating subject. Some called Love. I'll let you guys... Do you guys want to say anything about it?
I mean, I just... I
like the imagery in it.
Yes. I mean, I thought the film, you know, could have gone several different ways, and there were issues with it, and I'm a really good friends with the director, Braden. Yeah. He's an excellent sound designer, location sound man, and I just felt there were some issues in the actual, like, what you see on screen with, like, some soft focus shots that kept it. Yeah, it was technical issues that kept it from...
There were a couple of sound things where, like, things were too high. There was, like, a bit with a cell phone that was just too high, and things got grating at some point.
Yeah.
Okay, and just to wrap it up, I guess, tonight's special, I think, is an example of decent writing, good writing. Like, it's a strong...
It's by Alec Vasquez.
Alec Vasquez. It's a strong piece, and it had genuinely, like, funny writing. I thought Home, despite... I didn't love Home, but I thought Home juggled a lot of different aspects of it, and it felt occasionally like a TV show.
You got some excellent acting, though.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Home, and I thought she did a great job, and I thought it was just a really solid film, and that showed a lot of promise from the whole, just the ability to have so many balls in there and have a, you know, an enjoyable short film for me was...
Yeah.
Alex, I mean, wrapping up.
I just want to say, you know, honestly, you know, you're saying, Mark, that you're not sure if you'll be back next year. I know, without a doubt, I honestly do believe in Brooklyn College. I've seen some really, really just terrible filmmakers come out of Brooklyn College, but I've also seen the best filmmakers that I've ever had the privilege of working with. And so, you know, being that it's such a, you know, double-sided thing that could go either way, I'm, you know, really excited to see next year and to see the years going forward and to see how... you know, through the changes of the program, the art coming out of it progresses.
Nice. All right, Alex.
I just want to say, wrapping up real quickly, one thing I will say as a suggestion, and this is based off how great I thought the documentaries were. At the same point, I feel like Brooklyn College needs to separate a best documentary category, because if you're going to have documentaries mixed in, one thing I can't separate for me is the formalistic elements of a documentary and how they're kind of given slack, because it's like, oh, it's a documentary. So, like, maybe you can shoot on DV. Maybe you can shoot on 16 and have it be really grainy, and that's acceptable. Right. Whereas if one of the narrative films were to do that, it would be unacceptable. So I think Brooklyn College needs to separate and isolate a best documentary category. That was one suggestion. Another is, I feel like if they're going to keep moving forward and expanding with the growing audience, they need to have, like, assigned seating or a better way, because there was two different theaters, and I felt like... there was some rhyme and reason to
you
it.
You ditched me.
There was.
I had to ditch Mark because I produced someone's film and they wanted me to watch it.
But
I
didn't mind. Honestly, it was the first year that they were doing this two theater setup. So, you know, you got to give them a little bit of slack.
They did
a
good job.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, I think they really need, if you're going to do something like that and you're going to say there's a like a seating plan, I think you need to really devise a specific seating plan and just put a little more planning into that process. And then wrapping up, I just want to say, this was my first Brooklyn College Film Festival. I felt it was excellent. It's excellent quality of films. I used to attend Florida. I went to Florida State for a little while, tried to get in their film program. I've seen a lot of their screenings, and I would put Brooklyn College up against the Florida State film program screenings. And that's a program where you're given film to shoot. They're given access to a lot more professional quality, and Brooklyn College stood up to that. I'm very proud to have graduated from the school, and I'm just very happy for all the filmmakers.
So just quickly, I just wanted on what you were saying about documentary, just to pop in. I think that I agree with that, because if you're going to have a special program, now they've developed a program at Brooklyn College that's just a specifically for documentary production program, separate from the regular film production program, then you gotta have a special award for that, because these are people who are going in specifically for documentary, and they shouldn't be held to the same structural standards as, you know, not necessarily lower standards, but different standards.
And the reason, again, like we're both saying this, is because they're quality documentaries and they're quality narrative films, and they both deserve it.
Right.
Alex, thank you for coming aboard.
Thank you for
sitting down with us. Now Rick is shaking Alex's hand. Now I'm shaking Alex's hand. And now we're going to close out. We're going to take a short break. We're going to play you a piece by our producer, Mike Black. We'll let you know the title of the piece right after, and we'll let you know how to get at some of Mike's music. So here goes. All we do is play. Live in that college. You're here playing that way. Keep your shoes off. Baby girl, just kick your shoes off. I watch her as she's doing her Pilates stretching. So deep in our connection, we can find the sexing. She wants a man that works and takes it in the right direction. I want that job, so here's my resume, my style's my reference. And she glows with that certain look. I think it's magic, couple tricks about that Merlin's book. Sweetest wine sellers, deck up and pellets. No bullshitting, far from Penn and Teller. So we kick it for the weekend. Spilling that champagne as the sunrise, no sleeping. No need to watch our backs, we single, no creeping. Got an appetite for love, so we feasting, that's the reason. All grown, no vibration on the cell phone. We shut those off cause our connection goes beyond grown. Let's take time just to cool off. Just lay back and kick your shoes off. All right, we're back. That was Mike Black's Kick Off Your Shoes. He's got a mixtape dropping later this summer called Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone.
July 18th. All right, thank you, Mike. We got a date now. He's got a mixtape, Twilight Zone mixtape, dropping July 18th. And then toward the end of the summer, he's going to have his album, I Get Up. Jesus, we did not plan that. All right, here we are with Calvin Cal Robertson. Cal shot every film at the Brooklyn College Film Festival.
Only the good ones.
Not true.
Yes.
Not true. Not true. We're just kidding. But we're here with Cal to talk about his work. He was very well represented at the Brooklyn College Film Festival. I'm happy to say your work was absolutely excellent. And your film, Little Brother, ended up winning you
the Best Director Award.
Best Director Award. So, Cal, hi. Thank you for coming aboard.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us a little bit just where you're coming from? So people who aren't familiar with you can... You know.
Where am I coming from geographically?
Whatever you want.
You came from over, were you on Brooklyn College campus, or?
He was born on Brooklyn College campus.
I was born on Brooklyn College. No, I was born. I was born in the Midwest.
All right. So, professionally, where are you coming from? And what you want to do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Just give us a little bit of background so people are familiar with you before we jump into our discussion.
Well, again, my name's Cal. I have no idea what I want to do coming up ahead, except that I just want to make some weird films and probably shoot some more films.
You've worked like predominantly at your time at Brooklyn College as a cinematographer. How many student films did you shoot while you were there?
Like 12 or 13, something like that.
That's an impressive number. I mean, all things considered, how did you find... How did that fit into a schedule altogether?
It didn't really. I just, it was just hard work. Yeah, I would just work on the weekends on the film. It got easier over time because you get better at it.
No, we worked recently, and I got to tell you, you were not. This is nothing against other DPs I've worked with, but you work very efficiently, like very efficiently. Especially because you do a lot of dolly shots, and you get on the dolly pretty quick. I'll give you that much.
I like dollies.
Do you? Do you ever do shot reverse shot? I heard you're moving away from any shot reverse shot. Is that true?
Well, I just find them to be predictable.
Rick, do you want me to change seats with you so you can sit closer to Cal?
No, it's okay.
Just check.
Mark's got jokes. No, seriously though, because like Cal and I are friends with Cal's producer.
I've never seen you work. We've never been on set together, but from seeing your films, I have a lot of respect for what you do. Can we talk about Little Brother actually? Because
yeah,
you said
definitely.
You want to make some weird films, and I would argue Little Brother, from my point of view, was a conventional film. And I'm not saying that as a strike against it. I'm saying it felt like
a conventional film. It's not a weird film, but I specifically wanted to challenge myself to. I guess what I would say is that I came to school having made a lot of short films on my own, which were mostly image-based, not very narrative, more concerned with, I would say, the atmosphere of...
Well, you had made these while in art school or just, like, literally on your own apart from any kind of, like...
Just on my
school?
Own, okay. On my own, yeah. My goal was to... make this film as sort of conventionally as possible. And I restricted myself to the only kind of like iconic image shot would be, I don't know if you recall, there's a shot of milk in it.
Yes.
And I was like, that's
milk
the...
spilling on the floor. That's actually a great shot where it gets into the cracks in the floor. I remember that shot very well.
I was like, I wanted to kind of center around that shot and have everything else be more of a functional storytelling nature. I mean, I tried to be economical with the shots, but, because my tendency would be to do things differently than that. But I was like, I should challenge myself. I should think harder. Because that's much harder, actually, much harder to make a movie.
Oh, no, you're telling me. If I could, I would just have, like, cool shots. I would just stack cool shots on top of cool shots. But
They call you Michael Bay.
They call me Michael Bay. Listen, he's got cool shots, not much else. But, I mean, he has people that are writing for him. And, like, while at least we're at this level... like, we're mostly doing our own writing, at least. You do all your own writing, Cal, or do you have, like, a guest writer?
I've never written with anybody before. I would, because I think writing's really hard.
Mm-hmm. No, it is. Really? Mark, you're in the process of writing screenplay, too, right?
Yes.
Now. But you have a co-writer?
Yes, Ethan. I mean, okay. I talked about this.
I know, but I'm just saying, have you tried to write, like, any kind of, like, feature on your own? I've done it.
Yes,
it is just
I co-wrote a feature when I was younger, but we never did anything with it. And looking back, I look back at it now and then. It was called Insomniacs. It was about two guys who are both insomniacs who end up with a suitcase full of cash and a local drug dealer who
wants
to get
it back.
Wait,
you co-wrote that with Igor Yankelevich,
no,
right?
I didn't. I never...
He, okay, he also
I never,
has a...
Yeah, he has a film called Insomnia, which was a student film. But this film was sort of... It was a clear Tarantino ripoff, like a Guy Ritchie Tarantino ripoff. And what I do with the script now that I look back at it, to see what I've learned from it, because it wouldn't have made a very good feature film, but there were scenes in it that I was personally attached to, and I'll probably never use again, but I was happy to get it out of my system. And now that Ethan and I are working on the script together, we're doing writing exercises now, and we're finding it to be challenging, to say the least, but I'm really happy at the prospect of working with Ethan, because I feel like he's a talented guy, and our thoughts on the film that we're writing, which is a horror feature, fall into a very similar kind of... We challenge each other. We're also parallel to each other in where we want to take the film. So coming up with the actual story was easy, and I won't get bogged down. Yeah. Coming up with the story was easy. Writing it out is going to be hard, but I'll keep everyone updated on future podcasts.
One thing I will say, as someone who I like to produce, I like to AD, and like the first thing I do when I come on is I say, I want to see your script. And I want to take a look at it, and I'm going to tell you what I think. And
you're
I
Howard Hughes in The Aviator.
I immediately come on, and I want to see what I can do to it. And then oftentimes I'll do stuff, and the director will just be like, no, you can't do that. But I always, like, try to get in there and try. I'm not saying I want, like, creative control, but, like, I want to at least see what's going on. Now, Cal, I won't do that to any of your stuff. Don't worry.
So, Cal, okay, so Little Brother was your film, but what was it like? Can you talk a little bit about working on some of the other films? Because, I mean, you were I would never say overrepresented, but looking at that sheet of the films, you know, Cal Robertson and then just a list. And it wasn't, you know, it was like four or five films, but they were really quality films. And a lot of the time, frankly, your, you know, your eye for a composition and your general cinematography would raise a level of writing that wasn't up to par.
I mean, I think that I consider the directing of a film to be less important than the cinematographer. So,
and you're saying that as a cinematographer, not because you do you think if you were to say right now as a director,
I direct as a cinematographer. Mm. I try not to over romanticize the role of directing actors, because I think that all you really need to construct a film is some moments, some unguarded moments of reality from an actor or a non-actor. And I think that it's photographically captured and it's assembled in editing. And I try not to overstate the role of the director. So I think the filmmaker is the cinematographer.
Wow. I got to tell you, I don't know if I agree with that, because like on most of the things like I've worked on as a director, I've mainly focused on just the cinematography. Like I sit there at the camera and that's what I focus on. And what's suffered is the acting, or if the acting has been good at all, it's because of the actor,
I think that it only takes a small enlargement of the definition of what a cinematographer is to account for anything that a director would need to do. And I think you need to focus on the frame and you need to see if what's in the frame contains what you need later to construct the film. I mean, the film is a construction. It's not real. And the director, I think, is just usually given a little more credit than they deserve on all levels of films.
Okay.
I just think that film is a visual medium. And as a cinematographer, I don't talk to the actors, and if I'm directing or cinematographer of my own film, I will talk to the actors. So I will do more than I would do, let's say, on someone else's set. But I just don't feel any different if I'm shooting my own material as a director / cinematographer, or when I'm a cinematographer on someone else's set, except that I gotta, you know, just keep my mouth shut at certain times.
Well, all right. One thing I have to say real quick before we close out on this is that you've shot a lot of films, obviously. You've shot 12 to 13 associated with Brooklyn College. You've shot other films. Me working as an assistant director, because this is, I got to tell you, to me, I still think the director rules the house. The cinematographer can do what they want, but usually when I have an issue on set and it's a communication issue, I'm having to go to the cinematographer because something is wrong with him and the director. And when I work with a director who's really great, I can feel it. You can just feel you're working in the presence of a strong director. Do you still feel that? Like when you're with a director of a certain level who's maybe got like a grasp on every aspect of film form, with someone who maybe is predominantly a writer, like, do you feel that there's a difference between these different types?
Yeah, there is a difference. There is a difference.
Yeah.
But it's funny because like being overly visionary is a problem also. You know, if you have too clear of a conception of what you want, even if you do understand all the variables, I've seen that cloud someone's ability to see what's happening in the reality of the frame.
Okay.
And I've seen the opposite, where it's somebody just doesn't quite have enough grasp of the medium to be able to tell when things are spinning out of control and that they're not getting what they think they're getting. I mean, I think filmmaking is just extremely hard. It's extremely hard. And there's a lot of variables. There's a lot of things happening. It's a lot to keep track of. And I have no answer for how to do it correctly. All I know is that I feel that it's a visual medium. I don't think it's an actor's medium. I don't think it's a director's medium. I don't think it has very many similarities to theater. I don't think a lot of it has to do with writing. I think a lot of it has to do with image and sound and the way they're combined. But I'm not saying that the director has nothing. I kind of overstated it. I don't think the director has nothing to say, you know, and no input. I just think that it's not the singular primary.
So you're not you don't subscribe to like the auteur theory. You would not say that
that an auteur is behaving cinematographically, I guess you would say.
Can I jump in on this?
Yeah, certainly.
Just quickly some thoughts. I think directors are often outsized personalities, and I only know a few cinematographers who are famous for being outsized personalities, like Christopher Doyle, who's one of my all-time favorites, is known to be very kind of wacky and eccentric, but he produces gorgeous work. That said, I think Cal has a really like insightful way of looking at it, and while I agree with both of you, some aspects of what you said, I think the perfect, you know, great films occasionally come from just whether a director and cinematographer is in conflict. Sometimes the material is strong enough to withstand that, but when they're not in conflict and we're working together and there is no communication breakdown, so there are, but they're resolved not by an AD, but between the cinematographer and the director. Or, of course, you can have a great AD who's, you know, who kind of keeps everything afloat. Mm. But I think when they're working in tandem with each other to fill in each other's inequalities and to sort of produce a greater work, and they have their eye on the ball, I think that's when you get the films that are really formidable.
I will say, just from hearing David Fincher speak in person, who he's known for basically being, like, the cinematographer. Like, he has a cinematographer, and I'm not trying to marginalize what his cinematographer does. But this is a man who's known for his technical prowess. He started out, you know, in Industrial Light and Magic, so he has a feel for all these different things. And he was talking about, for him, his favorite movie is Chinatown, because it was an equal level of talent across the board. You had an excellent cinematographer, an excellent script, excellent actors, excellent director. They're all working, they're just at the peak of their profession, their different jobs within this profession at the same time. And he said to do that, they produced, to him, the best movie ever made. And, you know, that's up for debate. Like, I personally wouldn't put Chinatown in, like, the top 10, even U.S.
Right,
films.
Right, but a lot of people do consider, yes, general opinions about, yeah, about it.
So you have a guy who who's known for being, like, an egomaniac, who's known for controlling the image, saying that it takes all these points to do it, so.
I guess I'm more coming from, like, Robert Bresson and his theories of filmmaking and his approach, and he calls the filmmaker the cinematographer. And I don't, you know...
He's an excellent writer, too. That's the funny thing that you say that, though.
Yes.
I would say he's, like, an excellent writer.
Storyteller, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, but, yeah. If you have a director who's very talented, I think that they just understand how to bring these elements together. I just see it in the end as light projected on a screen or coming off of an LCD on your computer, yeah, whatever. I tend to look at it more as a formalist.
Okay. Closing out on... Right.
Rick, do you want to... Well, okay. Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to close out. Cal, thank you for coming aboard. Thank you. I think we really hit on some actual theory.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't talk more about Little Brother, your film. And you're going to submit it to other festivals?
Sure.
Yeah.
I get the feeling you've said what you wanted to say about Little Brother. I mean, maybe...
I don't really have much to say about it.
Well, yeah. I'm glad we talked about... We kind of, you know, wrote it out with the discussion of actual film and, like, director versus cinematographer. Now, that said, this has been, you know, our 20th episode and a special cut of our episode where we're covering the Brooklyn College Film Festival, this year's Brooklyn College Film Festival. You can find us at bkfilmtheorists.blogspot.com or on iTunes if you want to see, well, hear any, you know, the other 19 episodes that we've done. We've covered a lot of different subjects. And,
yeah,
you know,
Mark's favorite movie, Battle LA, is coming to Blu-ray,
that's
DVD
Mark's
this
favorite
week.
Movie.
So you can hear
that was Rick's
Mark
favorite
and I.
Movie.
Oh, yeah, definitely. My favorite movie of the year. You can hear what we have to say about that if you go and subscribe on iTunes.
Right, and just, so, you know, we really grew throughout these. I think Rick will agree. We've grown a lot as,
yes,
podcast hosts. And that said, we're going to close out now. For those of you who are willing to stick around, we're going to cover X-Men First Class. That's what I have to say about it. And we're going to close out with another portion of Mike Black's
Kick Off Your Shoes
here on the Brooklyn Film Theorists.
It seems she been waiting just to exhale all that hard work she put in, so rest well. Been making moves in those shoes for quite a while, so now she's able to kick them off and crack a smile. So Black Queen, let the sun shine. Rainy days will come and pass in due time. So let's relax and enjoy this weather and keep it cool and keep it cool as long as we together. Those back pains, let me search them. Rubbing on your body, let my hands play like your hands. Better yet, that shade, I would love be like clay, cause we can control it and mold it in our own way. Satisfaction be so guaranteed. No fallacies, only fantasies. Let's take the time to cool off. Just lay back and kick your shoes off. All we do is play. Live in that kind of electro hair, play it that way. Kick your shoes off. Baby girl, just kick your shoes off.
Boats and hoes. And we're back. All right, so that was Kick Off Your Shoes. Again, that's off the Twilight Zone mixtape by Mike Black, our producer, mixer extraordinaire.
Dropping July 18th. Am I getting that right? Yeah. Yes. Thumbs up. All right.
And I just want to thank our guests already. Cal Robertson, very interesting discussion. Alex Seuss, very interesting discussion. Thank you guys for both coming on. But now we're going to discuss one of the most hyped up movies of the summer.
Oh, yeah.
Matthew Vaughn's X-Men First Class. Mark, do you want to give a little plot rundown real quick?
Okay, sure. It's a prequel slash reboot because after...
Because every film needs a reboot in the 21st
absolutely.
Century.
Absolutely. After the 1-2 punch of X-Men Last Stand and X-Men Origins Wolverine, there was a script circulating for X-Men Origins Magneto. And I know a lot about this because I'm a big X-Men fan, so... Okay. And there's
just
a,
say it. It's,
okay,
it's
I'll
young
just
Magneto,
break it down. It was
young
no,
Professor
but there was
X.
yeah, it was yeah. it. There was a script circulating for like Magneto, and what we know from X-Men, this follows the mythology laid down by the movies, not so much, but comic books. But in the comic books and the films, Magneto, before he was Magneto, he was a Eric Lancher who was, I think, a Polish Jew who survived the Holocaust. And here in the film, we see him exhibit his powers for the first time in a concentration camp where there's a Nazi.
Played by Kevin Bacon.
Great.
Excellent performance.
Best performance in that whole film.
Yes.
It's hammy,
you're not
but it's
find
like
a debate
pricelessly
here on that.
Hammy. And his German is terrific. As opposed to everyone else who plays it, anyone who's Russian in the film. But that's going off topic.
Yes.
Young Magneto and young Xavier meet and their ideologies clash. And the mutant, this mutant sort of mutant community coming to light happens as at the flashpoint of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is what's used in this film, which is a really clever idea in you know...
In theory,
yes. So this is sort of the original mutant team, and I give them credit for actually using characters like Banshee or I think Havoc.
These are all original characters.
A lot of them are actual original characters, and I think they do a decent job with them, and you have someone like...
you're
Azazel,
talking to someone
the red,
know much.
The demon guy who
who's
can
never
teleport.
Explained to people because
Azazel, thank you, okay. Alex, and that's supposed to be Nightcrawler's dad, right? Am I right about that? Alex is nodding. Okay, so there's a whole history here, and
but there's a history based off the comic books that's
based
not
off
brought
the comic
to the screen
books and the films.
I would say
because
that
the bad
mutants aren't explained very well
not
in
at
X-Men.
All, except for Kevin Bacon, who's...
Yeah, no, he's
but in any case,
clearly.
What you have here, what the film's supposed to do, and what we'll talk about whether it actually succeeds or not, is supposed to show how these ideologies come into play and how they effectively lead to the rise of Magneto, as opposed to Eric Lancher. He could have been good, he could have been bad, but he becomes a this kind of like pro-mutant nationalistic figure, while Xavier becomes... more about integrating into society and coexisting. And that's the...
That's
you
the
know,
crux of the film.
That's the crux of the film. Right, and there. You could argue it's the crux of all three X-Men movies that came prior, because that, as well as Wolverine, because that's the ideology that makes it so interesting. Besides X-Men obviously consistently existing as an allegory for A, homosexuality, B, racial tensions, as this movie demonstrates
acceptance.
In the least...
You have, like,
in the stupidest
feminist
way
issues.
Possible. Yeah, feminist issues. This movie demonstrates racial tension by having Sebastian Shaw, Kevin Bacon, show up, say the word enslaved, and we cut to the only black character in the film, who's also... Well, not the only
Well,
black
aren't
character.
The only... Okay, so
but he's the first to die. The first mutant that dies in the movie is a black guy.
You
so
see
we're
a black
keeping that
you hear
tradition
the word
going.
Enslaved, you see a black guy scrunch
his
face
directly
up.
To the black guy.
2 minutes later, that black man has to die because that it's like we're trying to make this point, you know. And I was taking notes. I was like, great subtext with this, you know, black character because there's a point where they're like, how have you made it this long? And he goes,
and
I adapt to survive.
And he takes the name Darwin.
And I was like, wow, this is really building to something. No, it's building to him dying five minutes later.
Yep.
Oh, God, X-Men. I expected more of you.
So let's talk about what didn't work, for starters.
I
and
feel
then
like
we'll
the
talk
film
about
is
what
campy.
Worked.
I feel like the film is campy, and this what Bryan Singer...
It's very fan-pandering, I will admit that. Okay. So just,
what Bryan Singer brought to... somewhat of the first X-Men, but especially X-Men 2, was a weight to the film. He took it very seriously, and I think what he did with those films would lead to what Christopher Nolan would do later with Batman Begins, and then specifically The Dark Knight, which I'm a fan of those films. So I feel like Bryan Singer kind of set the template for a serious comic book adaptation, and I feel like Matthew Vaughn is reverting back to something that maybe more fans were into, like that campy Tim Burton, Joel Schumacher take on Batman, which I know a lot of fans who enjoy those, not necessarily Joel Schumacher's, but Tim Burton's like campy take.
Well, Batman Forever still has a better reputation than Batman and Robin.
Yes. I actually and am Tim a fan Burton, of Batman Forever,
Tim
but
Burton's,
on a cheesy level.
I will say Tim Burton had some camp in it, but it still had, especially Batman Returns, which I think was a really drastic move for Tim Burton, and that's why he didn't continue working on the franchise, because Batman Returns is an extremely dark film, and I think the gothic feel that he's known for really becomes very clearly active. But Matthew Vaughn comes, if you don't know, he was a producer for Guy Ritchie. He directed Layer Cake, which was a better Guy Ritchie film than Guy Ritchie has made in a long time.
Yeah, no, I loved Layer Cake. Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Then he did Stardust.
Which my mom has been like begging for me to see.
De Niro plays
so
a gay pirate.
Is it good?
It.
Okay.
De Niro plays a gay pirate. That's all I know about it. Okay. Then he does Kick-Ass, and that's how his name becomes known. Kick-Ass is a really solid action film. No, and I think he brings some of that fun to X-Men First Class. But I disagree with you completely that it approaches the camp of Schumacher's films, because I think there's still a serious emotional undercurrent. I just feel like it's mishandled in the film. But if you don't mind, I'd like to go over a little bit about the production history, because the film is really fascinating in that it has been completed in 10 months. It had a budget of, I think, $120 million, something like that. A huge budget, completed in 10 months with 5 different DPs, like 8 different writers, although Matthew Vaughn claims that he and his co-writer, whose name I cannot remember right now, they also co-wrote Kick-Ass, wrote the script that the film is based on. So I guess the fault lies with him.
One thing I have to say is the guy who wrote X-Men Last Stand was one of the producers, Simon Kinberg.
And so I'm guessing
he was brought... So you know they were brought on for rewriting somewhere in the process.
Yeah, and there was a lot of rewriting. But according to Matthew Vaughn, the script that the film is based on is completely his. They did a page one rewrite, and they didn't keep most of what was in the prior
script. According to this film also, the Russians were the good guys in the Cold War.
How's that?
Well, it makes it seem like Sebastian Shaw was the reason the Russians were interpreted as being bad within the context of the Cold War. So, like, we're getting like an Inglourious Basterds rewriting history.
I guess it mishandles that kind of tension.
I wouldn't even say
if you
want to
bring
it,
up Inglourious Basterds, we have one of the best parts of the film for me is Magneto hunting down Nazis in Argentina, which is great.
It was a great sequence, and it was really visceral. I felt
it was
he does
badass.
Kill
like,
the
it was one of those you rarely in this film, unfortunately, you rarely see use of mutant powers in a way that kind of, I guess, has an elegancy to it. Like the Nightcrawler attack on the White House in X-Men 2 is a really like an impressive piece of filmmaking, because you feel the weight of how people just can't stand up to this kind of power. Here it's thrown around so much, and there's so many unnecessary fight scenes, especially, let's talk about Angel, Zoe Kravitz, Lenny Kravitz's daughter, who plays the most useless character, like, in the whole film. She has no personality. She goes over to the bad
when
guy's
she
side.
Joins
from
the
literally,
dark side, it
I
makes
guess Sebastian
no sense.
Shaw shows up and he gives this really, there's a lot of really operatic, like, Faust Shakespearean speeches where it's like, my brothers, is this what we've come to? Everyone has turned against us. Will you not join me? And you have Xavier losing the use of his legs, but instead of feeling the pain that I imagine one would feel when a bullet shatters your spine, he has time to...
You're talking about the end of the film, which you know is going
to
come. But,
yeah.
But first, I mean, I just want to talk on the Zoe Kravitz scene, because this is like a major issue about the screenplay in general, is that like she's supposedly good. She's in a strip club. She's recruited, and she's like supposedly good. And then there's this scene where these two guys taunt her, and that taunting, which is like 30 seconds of screen time, supposedly leads
her
to becoming bad. Yes. And it's just not enough. And that's how I felt about the screenplay in general.
A lot of characters get the short, like...
It's not enough. They're not what they're depending on, and this is the problem with the Watchmen that, you know, disaster Zack Snyder adaptation was that they really lean on fans to know from the comic book. And I'm not a fan of the comic book. I'm a fan of the movies. I'm a fan of the theory of X-Men representing all these different, like, injustices in society.
I think some of that is in the film. And I have to disagree with you about Watchmen, but I won't go off topic. Yeah. I just think Watchmen is a failure on a number of levels. But what it does do is faithfully reproduce almost all of the comic book line for line, with the exception of the ending, which is a can of worms.
Yes.
That said, I think the crux of X-Men First Class is Magneto's change in ideology, and I think that's what makes the film tick, and that's also why the film doesn't work, because the focus on Magneto...
you know he's going to become bad all
you
along.
You do know, but it's how he becomes bad, and I think that's the strongest scene
really
in the film.
It happens really early in the film, though.
No, it doesn't.
What would you say is the scene where he switches over?
The critical climax of the film, which I think is a brilliant scene, and
when he's in the void, which is the Hall of Mirrors taken from Enter the Dragon.
We actually thought of we called Liberace's nuclear reactor.
Because he has all white on with diamonds.
That is the worst. Like, there's a lot of really funky James Bond stuff going on in the film, and I guess that's where the camera comes
from. Matthew Bond's
I'm sorry
gangster.
To spoil this for you guys, because you're here, but the critical scene in the film, I think it's a brilliant scene. When I break it down for you, I think you will agree. The movie doesn't make it as clear, but when you think about it afterwards, you have Sebastian Shaw, who's decided to make himself into a nuclear bomb by taking all the power from the reactor. And Magneto finally snatches this helmet off that's going to become Magneto's helmet that stops Xavier from getting into his mind. And Xavier stops Shaw. He freezes him. Yeah. And Magneto has the coin that he's carried around his whole life that Shaw used, tried to make him move. And because he couldn't move it as a child, Shaw murdered his mother. And he sends this coin through his brain.
What Which makes that just scene so brutally violent for a PG-13
yes,
film.
Yes, it was.
I'm
but what
saying.
Makes that scene brilliant is the fact that Xavier can't do anything. Because if he lets go of this man, he's going to release this power. And he's literally stuck feeling all the emotions that Shaw is feeling as this coin, like, is heading toward him. All that fear, like, that pain. You hear him screaming. I think that's an incredible scene that belongs in a different movie entirely. Because as soon as that scene is over and Magneto shows up in his fancy helmet and starts, like, being like, let's all stand on the beach for 15 minutes and decide who the bad guys are and who the good guys are. And I love the fact that all the bad guys, are just standing there. And then they slowly walk over to Magneto and they all hold hands so they can be teleported out of there. Really cheesy.
What about the fact that someone shoots Professor Xavier and the good guys just stand there until after everything is decided?
I think they're so
Then they run over.
I think they're so shocked. I don't have an explanation. But if you want to get into that. Okay, you know what?
Yeah.
I wanted to do this thing here. It'll only take like 3-4 minutes. I'm going to name you things that don't make sense. If you can explain them to me, do. If you can't, just say, I agree. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. So Eric Lanshear is in the concentration camp and he has to move this coin and he can't, and Shaw shoots his mother. Yes. And Eric starts turning everything that's metal into like garbage and he murders the two soldiers that were holding his mother by having their helmets crush their brains. He doesn't touch Shaw, the man who murdered his mother. Right?
Yeah. Why he doesn't touch Shaw, I have no idea. I agree.
Okay, good. I think I can get two more in there.
Okay.
When they meet Angel at the strip club, she shows him her wings with the window, like the room that they're in, it's fully open so people can see into it.
Yeah.
Rick?
Because of the Tinkerbell thing. People have been attracted to Tinkerbell.
She
since
grows
Peter
wings
Pan.
Out of her back. They're trying to hide these mutants, and she's in an open room and growing wings out of her back.
Because you're told not to look into the champagne room when you're a strip club. Because there's
so that's your explanation.
Security. I don't know. All
that's
right.
Your
it's
explanation.
Cheesy. It's cheesy as
it's
fuck.
It's not cheesy.
I don't know.
It doesn't make sense.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It really doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Last thing. You know what? Because that's the last hole I could think of. There's plenty more, I'm sure. All right. Banshee, right? Is the kid that can scream?
Yes.
He can't swim for that long in shallow water, I imagine, right? And once he lands underwater, we suddenly cut away from him, and then he shows up to fight Angel because they can both fly.
Yes.
Does that make sense to you?
I don't know. Why can Angel throw fireballs and
she
fly?
Can
Why
spit
does
them
she
out
get
of
two
her mouth?
Things?
I have
yeah,
no
she
idea.
Gets two different powers?
I have no idea.
Some people get one.
No
like...
idea.
All right, what I'm going to touch on real quickly is this film is, I guess, the way they decided to shoot it was just like a lot of backlight on the back of the head that's totally unmotivated.
Robert Richardson style.
And then you get this light on one side of the face and darkness on the other because, you know, fight with these mutants, they're some light and
There's
some
duality.
Darkness and all.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I have to bring this up. I'm sorry. They're in one scene, they're sitting in front of Lincoln Memorial playing chess on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial with the Washington Memorial in plain sight, and that's, I guess that's symbolism, because they're, it's retarded.
All right. Let's just wrap up. I'm going to give the film 2 stars, and I just want to touch on the reason I'm giving it such a low score, since everyone online and, you know, all these different media outlets are saying that the film is good. And the problem with me was the hype machine. I saw that initial trailer that we all saw, and I was genuinely excited.
Because it didn't look like crap.
It looked good. You get the Matthew Vaughn name, which if you're a fan of Kick-Ass and Layer Cake and Stardust, you're just genuinely excited. Then it has James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender, two upstart, young, talented actors for, you know, men to appreciate. Very attractive guys for the ladies, which that the theater was, I would say, over half women, which for a comic book movie, I think that's very good turnout. And I just felt all that talent was wasted with a very murky, campy script. Okay. So the hype machine made me think it was going to be 4. It didn't live up to it. 2 stars.
Okay. I give it a 6, I guess, because it still was... No, you know, out of 5. It was decently entertaining from time to time. No, I liked aspects of it. I think it fails overall. I think that ending scene is almost strong enough to lift the whole film up, but then you have that beach denouement that's kind of silly. Also, I have a totally heterosexual crush on Fassbender, James McAvoy, and Rose Byrne. See, Rose Byrne...
But she's a woman.
That's why it's heterosexual.
Okay, that makes sense. All
right, thank you, Rick. Overall,
you just threw in 2 guys, so you made that sound like it was...
Well, I had to say totally heterosexual, because if I had totally homosexual, it would be a different kind of crush.
All right.
That said, I just thought the film was rushed. It was rushed, and I think Matthew Vaughn does great work with the fact that it is rushed, but he can't cover up all those flaws. You have here what clearly looks like a first draft script, yet you have so many storylines competing for attention, and you just have, despite the acting, despite the fact that Michael Fassbender really walks away with the movie, and he makes a great Magneto, and Jennifer Lawrence, she's gorgeous.
She's Jennifer gorgeous, Lawrence, but she's not given that much to
no,
do.
No, but with what she does have to do, she, you know, she makes do with it, and she does make Mystique somewhat...
Mysterious?
Thank you, Alex. Yeah. Half naked. And there's a lot of fan pandering that both works and doesn't. There's a Wolverine cameo, spoiler.
That was one of the highlights of the film for
was it not
the
for me? For the
well,
audience,
not for
me, I was like,
for
whatever.
Me, I was like, oh,
Hugh Jackman's getting old.
Yeah. Wow. Whoa. All right, let's just stop it right
there.
We're
gonna
this
wrap
is too
it up. you know what? I think we have a minute. So, Cal, why don't you just jump in and talk about Tree of Life? Because we kind of dropped the ball on that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, could you sum up in 49 seconds some of your feelings on Tree of Life?
I love the dinosaur sequence.
Did you think that dinosaur, the one dinosaur killed
the
other
dinosaur?
He's like the
I Like Turtles guy.
Did you think, on gut reaction, did you think the one dinosaur crushed the other dinosaur's skull?
No.
You didn't. I did. Sorry, this is in the context of Tree of Life.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
I would have never imagined it was in the context of the film.
I know, but you're acting surprised.
I thought you were talking about actual dinosaurs.
Exactly.
I guess we both. The reason why I guess I don't know what ultimately happens with the 2 dinosaurs.
Did you? All right.
What I mean is just that I think that I understand the impulse to decide to open your character's stories with the birth of the universe. It sounds like something that many people have probably said they wanted to do, and apparently he'd been wanting to do that in several films.
Mm.
But he actually did that, which is... I just keep thinking about it. I just think it's awesome.
All right, well, it is
Rick,
awesome.
2 words.
That awesome.
Okay, we're the Brooklyn Film Theorists. This has been episode 20 for the 3rd time. Woo! Try to understand. Try to understand what this means to us. We'd like to thank...
You guys
Mike
have
Black.
No idea what Mark has to put up working with me. I just want to say thank you, Mark. I'm just a tough guy to work
I'm
with.
I'm the lucky one. We'd like to say thanks to Mike Black, our producer, Rob Chrisman, who produced our first
like
11
episodes.
Been great. Thank you so much. And, you know, we hope to work with you again in the near future.
Yes.
That said, we haven't figured out what we're going to do next week, but I am going to see Tree of Life because Rick is on me like white on rice for that.
Yes.
And we'll figure out what we're covering then. We're trying to move away from blockbusters.
It's probably going to be Super 8, though. We have to...
We're trying to move away from blockbusters, but we got to, you know, we got to pander to the lowest common denominator. Oh!
Ooh, all right. And on that note, here is Top Dollar Roz's The Man. I'm the most feared, revered of all reverence. Cause I bring the gospel, brand new testament. It's one sentence long, it don't bleed long, does not end. You see, I go, go, busy, when I put on my city, and I flow, go, something got like you, no, you, something. I go, go, busy, when I put on my city, and I flow, go.
If you want, but you know that you a fan. But on the really though, I don't give a goddamn. But respect is what it's given. It's something I demand. My suggestion is your...